That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 89 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-70s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
If it's in Texas, it's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Jove, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. Our first article will be from our April issue. It's almost done, so we're going to go into the state section today, and this is The Culture. It's books by Stephen Graham Jones. It's entitled this month, Conan the Vicarious. Growing up in a community not even big enough for a post office, I lost myself in the stories of the world's most famous barbarian. It would be years before I learned that his creator had also been raised in small-town Texas. I'm 12, and my uncle is walking me down the long hallway at the center of his house. We stop at what should be his linen closet, but when he opens the door, I see that it's crammed floor to ceiling and front to back with paperback novels. I can take three, he tells me, and when I'm done, I can bring them back and get three more. Because I don't know any of these writers, these genres, I take three books that aren't like each other. One of Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan adventures, a Louis L'Amour western, and a Conan the Barbarian novel. I don't remember the title of the book that took me on my first trip to the Hyborian Age. It could have been Conan the Destroyer, Conan the Defender, Conan the Magnificent. But I do remember it was a thick little mass-market paperback, meaning it probably wasn't written by Conan's creator, Robert E. Howard, whose books were usually slim. This being 1983 or 1984, my guess is it was probably hired gun writer Robert Jordan who introduced me to this muscle-bound, lithe-as-a-cat Cimmerian adventurer. It didn't really matter who had written it, though. It had a more exciting cover than any of the books at the school library. In a week, I devoured the three novels I'd borrowed. With the Mac Bolan, I understood the breakneck action well enough, but I hadn't read any Ian Fleming, so I didn't really get the appeal of this American James Bond or what he had to do with me. The L'Amour made a lot more sense. One side of my family farmed, and the other ran cattle, so when the dads and granddads and uncles came in from a day chasing strays or wrestling with a contrary knifing rig, there'd be dirt in their sweat and blood, just like the heroes in that horse opera. I was hooked deep enough that I burned through the rest of my uncle's L'Amour collection and then waited at the drugstore's round rack for the next one. But Conan the Barbarian. Imagine you're a Blackfeet kid growing up in the windswept pastures 20 miles east of Midland with no other Blackfeet around. Like Conan the Wanderer, the Adventurer, the Outcast, I was out in the trackless wastelands, far from civilization. The way I saw it, we'd come up the same. Conan's homeland of Cimmeria was high and lonely. From our back porch in West Texas, I couldn't see a single light. Cimmeria was packed with formative dangers. Every third step I took, I found myself entangled in barbed wire or jumping back from a rattlesnake. And when I mapped Cimmeria, the land Conan spent decades away from, onto my world, it could have been Montana, where the Blackfeet are. So I read these Conan novels for the adventure, sure. I was there for the priests of Set and the toppled kingdoms, for the taverns always snarling with violence. But more than that, I was there. I didn't tell anybody, but in my head, in secret, I was Conan. Like him, my people were from the cold and brutal north. I was just drifting through Texas, I hop a few walls, steal a few jewels, maybe fight a giant spider or two. When you're a kid looking over into adulthood and all its strange rites and incomprehensible motivations, one way to fend all that off is to align yourself with a different set of values. We all do it with whatever we have at hand, be it punk rock, comic books, motorcycles, Star Trek, it doesn't matter. What does matter is that we identify with it so completely that it insulates us from the real world, lets us be Conan the Invincible, the Unconquered, the Valiant, at least to ourselves. Don't worry, though. This isn't some lead-up to me walking away from childhood things. Those of us who believed in Conan at the right moment in our lives never stop believing. We might not grow up to become him, but we never grow out of him either. I still kind of want to be Conan the Freebooter, I mean. I think that's maybe what Robert E. Howard wanted, too. No, I feel that's what he wanted. I feel it in the urgency and the wonder he was able to capture on the page. But after reading Todd B. Vick's Renegades and Rogues, The Life and Legacy of Robert E. Howard on University of Texas Press, I have an even better sense of what Howard so desperately needed to escape. In Renegades and Rogues, we see a Howard who's locked in a dangerously dependent relationship with his mother, a Howard who has to shuffle through endless soda jerk shifts at a drugstore in his hometown of Cross Plains, Texas. It's not all doom and gloom, though. We also get a taste of Howard's heartfelt correspondence with the horror writers August Derleth and H.P. Lovecraft. We see him celebrate a story sale. And most importantly, we see him living his best life, not in that small house in Cross Plains, but through Cull, a thinking man's barbarian, and his other creations, Solomon Kane, El Borak, Bran McMorn, Breckenridge Elkins, and of course, Conan. When your own life isn't giving you what you need, you step into another, right? For however long he could make this next story last, Howard was Conan, or Skull, or Solomon Kane. Instead of caring for his ailing mother or suffering the withheld approbation of the people he saw on the street, he could write his best self into the larger-than-life adventures and freeboot his way, not just out of his own life, but into one so pungently real and vital that it still captivates us today. Yes, Howard was creating the sword and sorcery genre, but that wasn't necessarily his intention. As Howard himself once noted, he was rewriting history in the guise of fiction, and the history he was intent on improving, I submit, was his own. It's not just Conan stepping out of the shadows of that raucous tavern in the 1933 story The Tower of the Elephant and taking down the bully. It's Howard. He was living the only way he could, on the page. He was using a pen to carve his own world away, and the person left standing was the person Howard believed he could have been if he had been born in a very different age. This is how you save your own life. Or it's how you try to, anyway. You write your way over a wall and into a forbidden garden, where you bring lions down with a broadsword, climb ropes made from the tresses of dead women, fight spiders the size of pigs, walk across gem-encrusted floors, and do battle with dark gods and crafty wizards. And when the spiders in this role-playing game are that big, the wizards that dangerous, then you have to make your character bigger, badder, faster, stronger. In short, to survive, you have to become Conan. That doesn't mean the dice always rolled in Conan's favor, though. Take the end of The Tower of the Elephant. After slashing the lion and crushing the spider, Conan holds the tower's jewel in his hands, and yet, rather than abscond with the treasure, as we would expect Conan the Raider, the Renegade, the Rogue, to do, he does the right thing. He uses the jewel to release an extraterrestrial god from its imprisonment, then walks away empty-handed as he watches the tower come down in a crash of shining shards. Did Howard have Conan do this because this Cimmerian was actually a decent guy, as interested in justice as his pulp contemporaries, Batman, Sam Spade, The Shadow, and The Lone Ranger, all of them creations of the 1930s? I don't think so, no. The reason Conan doesn't walk away with his treasure that would have transformed his life is simply because Howard knew he was going to need to dress up as Conan again. If Conan were to sneak back out with this fabled jewel, then he would be swimming in gold and have no reason to start up another adventure. Conan the Triumphant, the Indomitable, the Champion. Not for long, please. If Conan gets away with the jewels, then Robert E. Howard has nowhere to retreat to. No place that offers the heightened action and mortal stakes he felt sorely lacking in Cross Plains and that he so desperately needed. Howard doesn't actually want the Tower of the Elephant's Jewel. He wants the wall around that jewel. He wants the lions in that forbidden garden and the guards he'll have to sneak past. The pig-sized spider scuttling at him across that gem-encrusted floor. The dangerous wizard waking from his lotus sleep with an evil hiss. In Cross Plains, all Howard had to fight were his own demons, the commonplace disappointments of his own life. So, in his Conan stories, he created fleshier, more impressive demons, demons he could actually knock down with a sword, at least for a while, or for as long as he could. At only 30 years old, a little more than a decade into being a published writer, all Robert E. Howard would be left with was that crash of shining shards. He took his own life in 1936, unaware that, decades later, his creation would reach a mass audience in comic books, movies, role-playing games, and three different TV series, with a fourth on the way from Netflix. For one glorious moment, however, this college dropout, one-time stenographer, and avid boxing fan, strode up out of rural Texas and into the Hyborian Age, and left the door open for the rest of us to walk through. For me, specifically, it feels like. I grew up in the same part of Texas you did, Mr. Howard. Our birthdays are even the same. And when the world doesn't make sense, I retreat from it just as you did. And I stand outside the Tower of the Elephant, and I smile because I know I shouldn't try to sneak over that wall. I know it's wrong and dangerous and probably going to end in disaster, if not death. But I jump that wall just the same. Some nights, I even find you already in there, Mr. Howard, and you shush me. There are so many dangers here. But then you hook your head to the side, a signal that I should follow you. I have been since I was 12, sir. Stephen Graham Jones is the Ivina Baldwin Professor of English at the University of Colorado Boulder and author of the recent New York Times bestseller, The Only Good Indians. Next up, still in state, we're at News and Politics. This is an analysis by Christopher Hooks entitled Power Plays. Governor Abbott and lawmakers want to blame everyone but themselves for the February blackouts, the latest crisis of their own making. A few years ago, a series of newspaper articles shone a harsh spotlight on the foster care system in Texas. Investigative journalists with the Austin American-Statesman and the Dallas Morning News documented stomach-churning stories of cruelty and neglect made possible by an overstretched and underfunded child welfare system. Turnover among caseworkers at Child Protective Services was sky-high, in part because of staggering caseloads that virtually guaranteed at-risk kids would fall through the cracks. In 2015, a federal judge wrote that Texas's system was one in which rape, abuse, psychotropic medication, and instability are the norm. In 2016 alone, 217 kids died from child abuse in Texas. Elected officials expressed shock and anger. Ahead of the 2017 legislative session, Governor Greg Abbott pledged to take urgent action to overhaul the broken system. Lawmakers berated child welfare leaders during committee hearings at the Capitol, providing clips to be used in local TV news broadcasts. In a letter to the head of CPS's parent agency, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, Abbott and then House Speaker Joe Strauss wrote that they would not tolerate the agency's unacceptable failures any longer. It was a good show. Such a good show, in fact, that it was almost possible to quiet some nagging questions. Did the politicians pass the rules and budgets that starved CPS and kept it from retaining a competent workforce? Weren't the governor and key legislative committees supposed to oversee the agency and its leaders? Weren't those in power ultimately responsible? Well, they were, of course, and they had no real reason to act surprised. The systemic problems that were hurting and killing so many kids were outlined in a 1996 report commissioned by Governor George W. Bush, a 2004 report by the Comptroller's Office, and a 2010 report commissioned by Governor Rick Perry. Nothing much changed, nor was there much improvement in 2017. That year, the legislature put a bit more money into CPS while also partially privatizing the system, despite warnings from some critics that doing so would create dangerous conflicts of interest. By 2020, the agency was in another crisis. Record numbers of children who'd been removed from their parents' homes were sleeping in agency offices for lack of any other place to send them. That's the way our state government works, more often than not. Elected leaders do their best to ignore real problems that only they can solve, giving them more time to micromanage the affairs of city governments and argue over who should use which restrooms. When someone forces them to acknowledge what isn't working, many state officials profess to be shocked by the shoddiness of the systems they oversee. And then, more often than not, they make token changes and move on. From the standpoint of self-preservation, this approach works wonderfully. State leaders rarely have to pay the piper because many Texans don't need or expect much from state government beyond, say, highway maintenance. The state may be congenitally inept, but many Texans don't know any kids in foster care or folks who lack decent schools or health care. Those are problems that are happening to somebody else. But what if something were to happen that exposed Texans from all over the state and all walks of life to that ineptitude? On the night of Sunday, February 14th, as Texas plunged into darkness and cold, as the lights and water went out, state government's incompetence stopped being somebody else's problem. Because it did not come in a familiar form, a hurricane, a wildfire, a flash flood, few Texans were aware on Valentine's Day that the state was about to experience one of the worst disasters in its history. Statewide power blackouts, triggered by a winter storm for which Texas was dangerously ill-prepared, will almost certainly go down in the history books as the most expensive disaster in the state's history, outpacing the $125 billion toll of Hurricane Harvey. The death count from the blackouts could also prove to be even higher than Harvey, which took about 100 lives. The stories of those deaths are horrifying. An 11-year-old boy in Conroe died of hypothermia under a pile of blankets in his family's mobile home soon after having played in snow for the first time. A 75-year-old Vietnam veteran went to his truck to fetch his last oxygen tank and froze there. An 8-year-old Houston girl died of carbon monoxide poisoning, one of 580 cases in Harris County alone, as Texans turned to generators and car engines in an attempt to stay warm. One doubts that these Texans and those needing dialysis and chemotherapy would be glad to go even longer without electricity if that's what it takes to keep the federal government out of their business, as former Governor Perry, one of the key architects of the state's failed electricity grid, defiantly wrote in a blog post that made its way to Fox News. The deaths will be roughly calculable eventually, as will the economic losses, but the psychological damage is harder to quantify, though no less important. For those who lost power, water, and cell service, the experience was briefly that of being part of a collapsing civilization. It came after a year of dealing with a pandemic and an economic crash that have already put Texans under almost unbearable pressure. I was one of the lucky ones. Though I was without power for 72 hours in sub-freezing temperatures, I did have food and water and a battery with which I could charge my phone. It was not an experience I would wish on my worst enemy. Or at least I thought so, until I found out that Ted Cruz had flown to Cancun amid the worst of the crisis. Most important, the pain fell across geographic and socioeconomic divides. The suffering, of course, wasn't evenly distributed. It never is, but nonetheless included many middle-class and affluent folks who have previously had little reason to doubt the state's ability to protect them. The experience of leaving a once comfortable suburban home to find firewood for heat was probably eye-opening. The winter storm that brought all this about, though severe by Texas standards, would have qualified as a brisk weekend in some parts of the country. Neighboring states were whacked by the same storm and didn't plunge into darkness for days. Someone in Texas had blood on their hands. But who? Texans were angry, and that anger was looking for an outlet. Politicians were nervous, palpably so. The effort to redirect the public fury began long before the snow melted. Texans looking to their governor for answers heard little at first. A day and a half into the crisis on Tuesday night, Abbott finally surfaced to be interviewed in the friendly environs of Sean Hannity's show on Fox News. Abbott pinned the blame on wind turbines, The blackouts, he told Hannity, showed how the Green New Deal and the rise of renewable energy would be a deadly deal for the United States of America. This was a few hours after the 11-year-old boy froze to death in Conroe. Our wind and our solar, they got shut down, and they were collectively more than 10% of our power grid, and that thrust Texas into a situation where it was lacking power on a statewide basis, he said. This was a lie. It was a convenient lie because it slotted the disaster into the familiar front of the culture war, green energy versus fossil fuels, New York socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez versus Texas. This mess was environmentalist fault somehow. The messaging was picked up by Texas Congressman Chip Roy and Dan Crenshaw, among others. The state's hapless agriculture commissioner, Sid Miller, told his Facebook following that we should never build another wind turbine in Texas. About half of the state's wind turbines froze, but the still-functioning wind farms produced more than they were expected to deliver in winter and helped support the grid as fossil fuel plants went offline. Solar panels, too, helped the grid avoid a worse crisis. Hours before his appearance on Hannity, Abbott told the truth to a Dallas local news station. The shortfall in electricity was largely caused by problems in the supply of natural gas, he said. It's just frozen right now. It's frozen in the pipeline. It's frozen at the rig. It's frozen at the transmission line. As the evil windmill boogeyman started to fade, another villain rose in prominence, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, a nonprofit council that administers the state's principal electric grid. When the power supply declined rapidly on Monday, February 15, it was ERCOT that gave the order to the various utilities around the state to cut off homes. Texans, who never had reason to know of ERCOT's existence, understandably assumed that this obscure entity had cast the state into darkness like sorcerers summoning a solar eclipse. This made ERCOT a convenient scapegoat. The next day, Tuesday, as Texans' anger was mounting, Abbott called on ERCOT's leadership to resign. Five of the board members did so a week later. He lambasted their total failure and accused them of keeping him in the dark about what was going on. Dan Patrick and a variety of lawmakers pledged investigations into the organization, ensuring that its executives and board members would face grillings throughout the oncoming legislative session. But ERCOT is not the all-powerful entity that its critics make it out to be. A technical body that plays a role analogous to air traffic control, ERCOT's leaders were powerless to overcome the high-level policy decisions that helped plunge Texas into crisis. Who, then, is to blame? Just as with the child welfare system, the buck stops with the state government, with lawmakers and governors past and present. For one, ERCOT is overseen by the Texas Public Utility Commission, whose three commissioners were appointed by the governor. He is the elected official most directly accountable for their performance, and through them, the performance of ERCOT. A quick couple of sidebars here. One is an illustration of the United States. It's got mostly gray, but there's some red around. The entire state of Oklahoma and Texas for the most part, a little bit in Kentucky and West Virginia, northwest corner of Oregon, and the southeast corner of California, and a few scattered red marks the rest of the way, a lot in south-central Virginia, and some up in New England. It says one of these states is not like the others. Remember, Texas and Oklahoma almost entirely colored by these red lights, and this percentage of homes without power, 100%, all over Texas and Oklahoma. More than 4.5 million customers in Texas were without power, as other states hit by the same storm fared much better. Map shows activity at 10 a.m. February 16th of 2021. Another brief sidebar here real quick. How expensive is electricity in Texas? Customers in the deregulated parts of the state, such as Houston and Dallas, have consistently paid more for electricity than ratepayers in still regulated areas, such as Austin, El Paso, and San Antonio. So it has three lines on this graph. The high point is 14 cents cost is per kilowatt hour. And it goes down to 9 on the upright bar of the graph. And going across the bottom starts 2004, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, and 2018. It's got a red line for Texas deregulated, a gray line for Texas average, and an orange line for Texas regulated. Texas regulated is the lowest. It does not ever climb above the 11-cent mark. Texas average never goes above the 13-cent mark, except right there in 2008, it gets right at 13 cents. Then the red line for Texas deregulated energy, its peaks are at 2006 and 8 at well over 14 cents, and then 2014 where it's over 12, and here right now 2018 at the end, it's at about 12, almost 13 cents. So very much more expensive. All right, back to our text. The utility commissioners are the sorts of figures a governor appoints when he wants someone to toe the party line, individuals with close ties to him and to the industry they're empowered to regulate. The chairman during the crisis, Deanne Walker, was a senior advisor to Abbott prior to joining the board. Before that, she was the director of regulatory affairs at CenterPoint Energy, the Houston electricity and gas giant. Another commissioner, Arthur D'Andrea, had been working for Abbott in various capacities since Abbott was attorney general. The commissioners are paid a median salary of more than $200,000 annually, but face little scrutiny. Last summer, the commission disbanded its oversight and enforcement division, which, among other things, investigates deceptive trade practices by electricity retailers, apparently because it was acting as a check on the commissioner's power. And in November, the commission unilaterally junked its relationship with the Texas Reliability Entity, an independent monitoring organization that makes sure electric companies follow state guidelines. Predictably, Abbott and his allies have directed fire at ERCOT, not his apparatchiks on the commission. But that blinders-on strategy isn't entirely working. In early March, Walker submitted her resignation, days after disappointing lawmakers with their halting and apology-free testimony at the Capitol. Abbott soon appointed D'Andrea, who had recently worked as a lawyer in the governor's office, the new PUC chair. Though Walker's a flawed messenger, her resignation letter contained a parting shot that shouldn't be ignored. Quote, I believe others should come forward in dignity and duty and acknowledge how their actions or inactions contributed to the situation, Walker wrote, specifically naming the legislature as one of the culpable parties. It's true, even Abbott and the PUC are not ultimately responsible for Texas's unusual electricity system. The Texas legislature is. In 1995 and 1999, lawmakers from both parties undertook a far-reaching experiment by deregulating the state's power sector, part of the marketization binge that began in the 70s and transformed the telecom, pipeline, and airline industries. The idea was to introduce competition and choice to the state utility sector and empower an unfettered market to make electricity cheaper for consumers. The evidence on that last point is mixed, but consumers in parts of Texas that remain regulated, those served by investor-owned companies like El Paso Electric, city-owned utilities such as Austin Energy and CPS Energy in San Antonio, as well as rural electric cooperatives, enjoy cheaper electricity than those in the much larger part of the state that deregulated. Those deregulated consumers have paid a surcharge that, according to a recent Wall Street Journal analysis, amounted to $28 billion over the last two decades. Take a quick break here to remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and the Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, or streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listen at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight in the Sound Broadcasting since 1967. The cost to ratepayers from the winter storm disaster is still being tallied, but the financial fallout is likely to be enormous. The state's oldest rural electric cooperative, Brazos Electric Power Cooperative, filed for bankruptcy protection in early March, citing an inability to pay a $2.1 billion bill for power it purchased during the crisis. Customers of CPS Energy may spend the next decade paying down $1 billion in storm-related costs. It's not just San Antonio. Ratepayers across the state are likely to face higher electric prices for years to come. Deregulation also made the grid less robust and less resilient. Unlike most states, Texas has no capacity market with which electricity producers are paid to ensure generating capacity on future dates. Instead, the energy-only system relies on high wholesale power prices to encourage more generators to come online when demand rises. That's why some Texans with contracts pegged to the wholesale electricity market have been getting post-freeze electricity bills in the tens of thousands of dollars. Customers of grids with capacity markets pay a slight premium for electricity in exchange for more reliable power. While most of the state suffered through blackouts and water outages, El Paso and part of the Panhandle were barely affected. That's because they, along with some counties in East Texas, aren't part of ERCOT. Instead, they plug into the nation's two other grids, which allows cooperating states to rely on each other during emergencies, overseen by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC. Those grids have capacity markets to ensure power amid surges in demand, and they require the weatherization of critical infrastructure. After the Texas disaster, journalists in states such as Arizona and Colorado began asking, could it happen in our states? No, they concluded. The grid was too robust. What happened in Texas, amid freezing weather that struck most of the country, appeared to be a peculiarly Texan disease, as illustrated by the map we discussed earlier. The independence of the Texas grid had long been a point of pride for the state's politicians, but there are perhaps worse fates than enduring a bit of federal oversight. In 2011, when a less severe winter storm hit the Lone Star State, the grid suffered rolling blackouts. FERC issued a report that recommended that Texas winterize power plants to prevent worse crises in the future. Several bills that would have acted on the FERC recommendations died amid heavy lobbying from utility interests in 2011 and subsequent sessions. As mounting anger required more scapegoats, statewide officials such as Greg Abbott lucked out. The state's junior senator, Ted Cruz, flew to Cancun, then lied about his reasons for leaving and was shamed into returning, looking like a puppy that had peed on the rug. While the story sucked up oxygen, the lights came back on for most Texans. Those who are responsible for the dark days of February in the first place will make some changes, but otherwise they hope that you will forget how mad you were, and they hope that you won't figure out who to be mad at. Much of Texas gained access to electric power less than a century ago. Rural electrification helped lift many Texans out of a cyclical trap of poverty and the back-breaking physical labor of hauling water from wells to homes. Was made possible by politicians, among them Lyndon Baines Johnson, who believed that the point of obtaining political power were to use it to create security and opportunity for those who elected you. These politicians weren't pure idealists. They were no less conniving or corrupt than political leaders today, and perhaps more so. But they believed that politics had a purpose. Today, there's another kind of politician, one that's harder to understand. When Texas politicians deregulated the electricity market, they tried to delegate responsibility for a core government function to for-profit actors and distant bureaucrats. This abdication of governance gives lawmakers plausible deniability for whatever comes next. When something goes wrong, they are quick to blame everyone but themselves. They can't wait to move on. Responsibility isn't something other people are supposed to take. After ERCOT's board members resigned, Abbott issued a statement putting the blame for all that had happened at their feet. When Texans were in desperate need of electricity, ERCOT failed to do its job, and Texans were left shivering in their homes without power, he said. I welcome these resignations. The state of Texas will continue to investigate ERCOT and uncover the full picture of what went wrong. No mention of the PUC's responsibility to oversee ERCOT, the governor's role in appointing the pet rock PUC commissioners, or the role of the legislature in creating the failed grid system. 2 weeks later, he changed the conversation by abruptly lifting the state's remaining COVID-19 restrictions, including the statewide mask mandate. The scapegoating strategy seemed to work. Abbott's approval ratings hardly budged in the immediate aftermath of the storm. On February 22nd, Patrick held a press conference at the Lubbock Airport, part of a damage control tour. Addressing the question of why the legislature hadn't ordered power plants weatherized after the 2011 winter storm, Patrick, the second most powerful politician in the state, said that lawmakers had suggested to the PUC that plants be winterized, and we were told that they followed up on our recommendations. Besides, he said, shrugging, we're not in the business of trying to tell everyone what to do every day. Next up, still in state, we got Being Texan. This is History by Julia Swag, and the column this month is entitled Alone in a Crowd. This exclusive excerpt from a new biography of Lady Bird Johnson chronicles the first couple's emotionally fraught experience attending Robert F. Kennedy's funeral and burial. Julia Swag's just-published Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight on Random House, is the most significant biography of the late First Lady to appear in more than two decades. For the book and her new ABC News podcast, In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson, Swag, a non-resident senior research fellow at the University of Texas at Austin's Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, drew on audio diaries that Lady Bird kept during her White House years. The 123 hours of tape, which had been hiding in plain sight for years, a heavily redacted selection was published in 1970 under the title A White House Diary, portray Lady Bird as a far more active and influential participant in the LBJ presidency than most observers have thought. They also offer a vivid and up-close narrative of American political life during the 60s, featuring a cast of characters that includes Martin Luther King Jr., Jacqueline Kennedy, and Richard Nixon. In this excerpt, the first couple attends Robert F. Kennedy's 1968 funeral in New York City. The Johnsons were as shattered as the rest of the country by RFK's assassination, but their strained relationship with the Kennedy clan made the event a difficult one for them to navigate, as Swag and Lady Bird make clear. The morning of Robert F. Kennedy's funeral, Lyndon and Lady Bird turned to their usual review of newspapers, finding them drenched with every aspect of the story, as she recorded in her diary. The relentless media exposure of the violent details of Kennedy's assassination on June 5, 1968, and the painful displays of family and national mourning had exhausted the country and the Johnsons. It would be a long day, attending the funeral at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, receiving the train carrying RFK's coffin, and encouraged an entourage later that afternoon back in Washington, joining the procession through the Capitol to the burial site at Arlington Cemetery. During LBJ's last trip to St. Patrick's 2 months earlier for the ordination of the new Archbishop of New York, the crowds had greeted the president with a measure of respect and relief, reassured and impressed by the statesmanship of his withdrawal from the presidential race 4 days earlier. But the tectonic political and emotional shift of a country wrestling with the assassinations of RFK and Martin Luther King Jr., a country whose maladies LBJ had come to personify at home and abroad, was now palpable in the crowd inside and outside St. Patrick's. On the Saturday morning of June 8th, New York was a strange sight, Lady Bird recounted. The streets were lined with people who stood silent, motionless, the voiceless chorus of a Greek tragedy. St. Patrick's was filled to overflow with 4,000 people. Inside, an absolutely stricken Pierre Salinger, RFK's campaign manager, escorted the Johnsons up the nave. They paused briefly as they passed Bobby's flag-covered coffin before taking their seats in the front row on the left side of the aisle. Just as they moved into their pew, the congregation, silently and without signal, rose to its feet. Lady Bird's predecessor, Jackie Kennedy, in black and veiled, had entered, along with John Jr. and Caroline. JFK's widow and children walked past the Johnsons to take their seats in the front row on the right side of the aisle, the Kennedy family side. Bobby's widow, Ethel, and her 10 children, who ranged in age from 1 to 16, sat to the right. A third widow, Coretta Scott King, sat a few rows back, also, Lady Bird noticed, on the Kennedy family side of the aisle. Under the cathedral's vaulted ceilings mourned members of Congress, current and former Kennedy and Johnson cabinet members, the Goldbergs, the McNamaras, the Rusks, the Dillons, the Harrimans, military brass, New York's Sons of Philanthropy, and the country's leading journalists, artists, and intellectuals. The pews were filled with campaign and policy advisors who just 2 days earlier had imagined themselves staffing an RFK White House, and with the leaders of the new American political coalition. RFK had begun to stitch together during the primaries, including activists Cesar Chavez, John Lewis, and Dolores Huerta. Other than George Wallace and Dick Gregory, every 1968 presidential candidate sat among the mourners. And so, too, did each of Lady Bird's potential successors, Muriel Humphrey, Abigail McCarthy, Happy Rockefeller, and Pat Nixon. Lady Bird could see Leonard Bernstein only from behind, but as he conducted a painfully beautiful rendition of Mahler's Adagietto from Symphony No. 5, she saw in him an expression of the utmost of passion, of torment, and talent, words Lady Bird may well have reserved for Bobby himself. In some ways, the gathering felt like a requiem, not just for Bobby Kennedy, but for the Democratic Party, or for the Johnson chapter in American political history. Senator Ted Kennedy's most beautiful eulogy equally moved the First Lady. Well practiced in scrutinizing how public figures delivered their messages and connected with their audiences, Lady Bird captured the moment. Partway through, his voice began to quiver, but then came under control and ended calmly. Teddy's eulogy included a composite of a number of speeches his brother had given in South Africa, in Mississippi. His eyes red-rimmed, Teddy asked that his brother be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it, she recorded. Another line of sheer poetry from George Bernard Shaw that Bobby had often paraphrased, although the First Lady didn't know its provenance, was also memorable. Some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not? At that moment, the purity of grief had transcended the resentments that had built up between the Johnsons and the Kennedys over the years. The President and the First Lady were the first to exit the cathedral after the funeral. On their way, they walked over to the Kennedy family. The Patriarch, Joseph Patrick Kennedy Sr., who in 1955 had offered to back an LBJ presidential bid if he would make Jack his running mate, had been unable to travel to his son's funeral, his health severely diminished by a stroke. But LBJ shook hands and spoke briefly with Teddy, and Lady Bird grasped Teddy's hand too. They stopped to speak with Ethel, Bobby's greatest advocate and protector, her face beautiful, sad, and composed. They spoke to several of her children and also to Rose Kennedy, the matriarch, whom Lady Bird had admired when they first met at the Kennedy family's Hyannisport compound in August 1960. During that visit, just after the Democratic convention when the Johnsons accepted the vice presidency and threw their lot in with the Massachusetts Klan, Jack and Jackie had gone out of their way to make the Johnsons comfortable, hiding their own toothbrushes, emptying their drawers, and squeezing into a twin bed in the guest room so the Johnsons could spend the night in their room. It was also, apparently, when Jackie began to develop her first impression of Lady Bird, whose habit of taking notes whenever her husband spoke reminded Jackie of a trained hunting dog. That was a severe misjudgment of Lady Bird's ability to deploy her 360-degree powers of observation and encyclopedic recall in the service of Lyndon's and her own sizable ambitions. It had been almost 8 years since that visit, when a pregnant Jackie had asked Lady Bird's advice on how best to help her husband's candidacy while sitting on the sidelines, minding her womb. And it had been almost 5 years since Jackie and Lady Bird navigated, together and separately, the brutal reality of Jack's assassination and the 14 excruciating days of transition that followed. Little sidebar, imagine if she'd had Twitter. Between November 30, 1963 and January 31, 1969, about 6 years, Lady Bird recorded 850 diary entries. Back to our text now. In nearly weeks and months after Jackie's exit from the White House and then her departure from Washington, the Johnsons had stayed in touch with her with letters and with invitations. All declined. They renamed the White House's redesigned East Garden the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden, even as Lady Bird finally felt she had gotten out from under Jackie's shadow. She built on Jackie's initiative to fill the White House with notable works of art and continued with her historical preservation projects. But there was only so much Lady Bird could do to heal the wounds of November 1963. By June 1968, Jackie had been living on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan for 4 years and had begun to date Aristotle Onassis, a Greek shipping magnate far older and shorter than the multilingual equestrian debutante. After the warm exchange with Ted, Ethel, and Rose, Lady Bird perhaps expected to find a similar display of manners from the wounded yet ultra-careful Jackie, the one Kennedy with whom she shared the most history. Not so. And then, Lady Bird recorded, sounding a bit perplexed, I found myself in front of Miss Jacqueline Kennedy. I called her name and put out my hand. I hardly know how to describe the next few moments of time. She looked at me as though from a great distance, as though I were an aberration. I felt extreme hostility. Was it because I was alive? At last, without a flicker of expression, she extended her hand very slightly. I took it with some murmured words of sorrow and walked on quickly. It was somehow shocking, Never in any contact with her before had I experienced this. Jackie's losses had again mounted. Two infants, one husband, now a beloved brother-in-law. Defying the mythology of Kennedy's stoicism in the face of tragedy, she had practically collapsed at one point during the ceremony. Making Lady Bird feel at ease, a skill Jackie had mastered between 1960 and 1963, was perhaps not her highest priority in 1968. Was it a measure of survivor's guilt that Lady Bird had projected onto this potent encounter? She had every reason to feel it. Her husband was still alive, even if his presidency was politically moribund. As Jackie, Coretta, and Ethel mourned their fallen husbands, Lady Bird felt especially helpless and purposeless. Once again, the country is being revived by the sight of a Kennedy wife behaving with perfect nobility, the journalist Mary McGrory wrote of Ethel's grace at the funeral. Perhaps the hardest truth was that there was nothing Lady Bird, in her capacity as First Lady, could do to provide comfort to the three widows or to a mourning nation. After Lady Bird returned to Washington, she spent the rest of the day unable to concentrate on work. She played bridge with her daughters, hung in this interval of time between the funeral and the burial with everyone in a sort of emotional trance. After a family dinner with Reverend Billy Graham, now a regular at the White House, the Johnsons were finally summoned to Union Station, where the train carrying Bobby's body, Ethel and the Kennedy clan, and hundreds of friends, journalists, and political allies would shortly arrive. From there, the President and First Lady would accompany the funeral cortege to the burial at Arlington Cemetery. Inside the huge concourse, the vaulted doorways were draped in black, as the White House had been in 1963. The last time Lady Bird had been at Union Station as part of a funeral was for General Douglas MacArthur in April 1964. She stood then with Bobby Kennedy, still the Attorney General, waiting for MacArthur's train to arrive from New York. Bobby turned to her and said, "You're doing a wonderful job." He paused and added, "And so is your husband." It was a single kind moment in an otherwise fraught relationship. Overcome by Rose Kennedy's suffering and also by her strength in the face of so much tragedy, Lyndon welled up with tears during the rainy ride to the station. Lady Bird tenderly touched his arm. When they arrived, they found Vice President Hubert Humphrey and his wife, Muriel, waiting and invited them into the presidential limousine. The ever-ebullient Hubert, then in the midst of what would turn out to be a successful run for the Democratic nomination, looked for once drained and empty. The 21-car train that finally arrived carried what only a few days before was the nascent RFK administration. The Johnson's limousine followed the 14 cars behind RFK's hearse. The motorcade's route traveled from Union Station along First Street, turned west along Constitution Avenue, where it paused at the Justice Department, where Bobby had served as Attorney General, and then west to the Lincoln Memorial, past Resurrection City, an encampment on the National Mall, established in the wake of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination to highlight the indignities of poverty in America. There, under a bright moon, the cortege stopped. Onlookers, at times six people deep, lined the lawns and sidewalks nearby. From Washington, Maryland, and Virginia, some from the South, others from across the country, they'd been waiting all day. The raised fists of the crowd at Resurrection City cut a dramatic contrast with the Cadillacs and the National Guardsmen posted nearby. The Marine Corps Brass Ensemble accompanied two local choirs to perform Battle Hymn of the Republic, but the Secret Service cautioned Lady Bird against lowering her window to listen to the abolitionist Julia Ward Howe's classic of the American Songbook. People, more people, candles in hand, lined Memorial Bridge across the Potomac to Arlington Cemetery. There, too, Americans had been waiting for hours to see the cortege passed. Inside the gates of the cemetery, more candles still. Kennedy family friend Bunny Mellon had selected the gravesite on a slope shaded by two magnolia trees right close to President Kennedy's tomb, Lady Bird recorded. Joe Califano, one of LBJ's top aides, had negotiated every detail of the Johnson's role for that day. Going over the choreography, Califano had told the president that when the flag came off the casket, they want you to present it to Mrs. Kennedy, to Ethel. "I'll be glad to do it, but I want you to make sure that this is what the family wants," LBJ replied. Califano reassured him. "Yes," he said, "we've asked them three times." LBJ said later that he was glad his last meeting with Bobby a couple months earlier, the day before MLK's assassination, had been at least outwardly friendly. The day after RFK's funeral, New York Times journalist Max Frankel captured the two men's braided fates. Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy thought of each other as unruly detractor and unqualified usurper, and their thoughts of each other could provoke them to private profanity, yet they fought by the proper processes and peculiarly respected even what they resented. For a decade, their lives were tautly intertwined, and as they pulled apart politically, they managed only to strangle one another. Lyndon was confounded by his inability to read the Kennedy clan and deeply frustrated by the rejection of his talents during his years in the White House. In the end, after a brief ceremony, the Johnsons hung back. They stood when the family stood, kneeled when the family kneeled, and watched as one of the pallbearers, astronaut John Glenn, folded the flag with military precision and handed it to Teddy Kennedy. And Teddy, not LBJ, carried it to Ethel. This was, Lady Bird recorded, as it should be. Knowing the family's wish to linger alone, the President and First Lady said their goodbyes to Ethel and walked down the slope, Washington's monuments and the Capitol Dome illuminated ahead of them. There was a great white moon riding high in the sky. A beautiful night, Lady Bird recalled. This is the only night funeral I ever remember, but then this is the only such time in the life of our country, an incredible, unbelievable, cruel, wrenching time. All right, still in the state section. Gosh, we can't hardly get ourselves out. Anyway, this is Meanwhile in Texas. A policeman and his canine officer stopped a carjacker in San Marcos as he attempted to steal a vehicle with two girls in the back seat shortly after boosting another automobile. An 83-year-old Red Rock man gave a Buick to an Amazon driver for summoning emergency help when she found him lying alone in the snow with a broken femur. After the Stinnett police chief proposed to his girlfriend, she discovered he allegedly had faked a document demonstrating the annulment of his current marriage, for which he was arrested. When asked to sign a citation for failing to signal a lane change in Progreso, a man wrote FU in the space designated for his name and was then arrested on charges of tampering with a government record. A Lake Jackson mother called police to report a man peeping into her teenage daughter's bedroom, then tackled the suspect as he attempted to flee. The Federal Bureau of Land Management offered Texans as much as $1,000 to adopt a wild horse or burro in Beeville after wildlife authorities determined that 10 western states had 69,000 more animals than the range could support. An Austin nursing student saw his grandparents in person for the first time in nearly a year when he administered their COVID-19 vaccines. Now it's all put together by Sierra Juarez. And we turn now to the dining guide, get a few local places around the area so we see what's going on in the new foods and stuff. This is an update of Galveston Boulevard Seafood, $3 signs. It's a seafood restaurant, obviously. Seafood is king in this coastal city, and this spot attracts crowds with its generous portions and fresh takes on timeless classics. Order this to go. Lunchtime sliders in all kinds of varieties. Beef and cheddar, crab cakes, fried shrimp, and a side of crisp fries are perfectly portable and satisfying. Dinner time brings steaks and seafood platters, but we made a meal off of happy hour martinis, shrimp kisses, which are plump bacon-wrapped shrimp served atop balsamic drizzled grilled onions, and cups of creamy chowder chock full of fish, shrimp, and clams. A pro tip, wine is half off on Wednesdays. It's at 28th and Seawall. Call ahead 409-762-2583, on the net at blvdseafood.com. And let's see if we've got anything else here. Bryan College Station, Gate 12 is a new place. It's a steakhouse. Prime spot for both airplane and beef enthusiasts. There's bar and grill inside the former General Aviation Terminal next to Easterwood Airport. Pairs good food with runway views. The restaurant's self-described atmosphere of relaxed elegance includes menu options that range from ribeyes to shrimp and grits. Order this to go, the beef stroganoff made with seared tenderloin tips and a lightly applied fond de veau sauce. A pro tip, if you're comfortable dining inside, make a reservation to guarantee a seat near the windows overlooking the runway. It's 1770 George Bush Drive West, College Station, 979-775-9925, and that is a $3 sign location. All right, and fortunately, we're at the end of our time for today, and it brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2 on Sight into Sound Broadcasting, your print information.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Midland Odessa Symphony and Chorale will present Take 3 at 7:30 p.m. May 1st at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center, 1310 North FM 1788 in Midland. Take 3, joined by the Midland Odessa Symphony Orchestra and conductor Gary Lewis, will present a high-energy performance highlighting the powerhouse trio of musicians, including a violinist, cellist, and pianist. Masks are required, and seating for this event will be socially distant and limited. Tickets are $30 to $50. Students are $17. For tickets, visit mosc.org or call 800-514-3849 or stop by the Wagner Noel box office.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on the Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades. The Blind Handyman, direct from Lufkin, Texas. Monday nights at 7, Saturdays at noon, and Sunday nights at 11 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Looking out at the road.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 91 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-70s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Traveling Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the April issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with Lights, Camera, Wildlife. Ben Masters goes a Texas mile to capture the state's iconic species and landscapes by Melissa Gaskell. Ben Masters makes films celebrating the wilderness of Texas, propelled by riveting scenes of adventure and cinematic grandeur. For 2015's Unbranded, he and three other men rode Mustangs 3,000 miles from Mexico to Canada. In 2018's The Return of the Desert Bighorn, he documented the reintroduction of the rugged sheep to West Texas. In 2019's The River and the Wall, his hardy crew journeyed by bicycle, horse, and canoe along the Rio Grande from El Paso to the Gulf of Mexico. Master's latest work, American Ocelot, tells the story of the country's most endangered wildcat. Ocelots still live in Central and South America, but in the U.S., their range has dwindled to South Texas, where fewer than 100 live in Cameron and Willacy counties. American Ocelot follows biologists who study the spotted cats in an attempt to capture the first high-quality footage of wild ocelots ever taken in this country. Spoiler alert, they succeed. Masters, who was born and raised in Amarillo, studied wildlife biology at Texas A&M University and now lives with his wife and daughter in the state's filmmaking hub of Austin. The 32-year-old describes Deep in the Heart, his project due for completion next year, as a wildlife documentary with grand ambitions worthy of his home state, a planet Earth for Texas. How did you spend your time growing up in Amarillo? I came from a ranching and farming family, and my dad often took me hunting. I became fascinated with the species that you don't hunt. I've been known to do more bird watching than deer hunting in the blind. How have you seen Amarillo change since your childhood? There are a bunch of windmills up there now, but the people are still pretty much the same. The canyons are the same. There's still a lot of agriculture and not enough water in the aquifer. I'd say it hasn't changed that much. What did you enjoy most about studying biology at Texas A&M? I'd always been fascinated with nature, but I got to learn about the history of conservation in the state of Texas and the country as a whole. Texas has changed so much, and a lot of those changes are positive. Look at where we are now with big, charismatic megafauna. There are so many more bison and bighorn sheep, mule deer, pronghorn. We figured out how to recover so many species. Some species, such as the ocelot and Texas horned lizard, will be harder to bring back. But we have success we can point to, living proof that we can do it. How did you get into making films about wildlife and the outdoors? I started making movies right out of college, and I saw that movies have a real ability to create change and inspire folks. I did a lot of short films for different conservation organizations to help them get support and recognition for their restoration efforts. I feel fortunate to get to do what I love and help our organizations that are doing amazing things. Your work has taken you across much of the state. If you had to pick a favorite Texas vacation spot, where would it be? I don't want people to go there, so I'm not going to say. Seriously, though, floating any river, especially the stretches where people don't go very often, the Nueces, the Frio, Colorado below Austin, we're a state of rivers. Which of your films has been the most difficult to make? There are different kinds of challenges. Some come in the field, footage footage of ocelots are definitely the hardest to get. Getting a story right is also really difficult. I think I did a good job with the river and the wall, showing the potential effects of the border wall without being too partisan and with respect for multiple viewpoints. What was most challenging about filming along the Rio Grande? We got in a massive canoe wreck on Upper Madison Falls. Canoes turning over, stuff washing up in Mexico. It was a full-on disaster. We got enough of our stuff back to keep going. The most rewarding thing on that trip was just to see so many of the people who live on the border, to hear their perspectives. The landscape was absolutely awesome. There are a lot of special rivers in Texas, but nothing like the Rio Grande. Why do you take a character-driven approach in your films? Because people connect with people. Most of our films tell a story or issue through a character, someone looking at something larger than who they are. In American Ocelot, Professor Mike Tews, biologist Hilary Swartz, and rancher Neil Wilkins allowed us to tell audiences the challenges that ocelots face as a species, as well as recovery methods we could be employing to help bring them back. What drew you to ocelots? Filming the river and the wall, we were looking into the effects a wall would have on wildlife. I had assumed that it was going to have a great impact on ocelots here because they would not be able to cross between populations in Mexico and Texas. But when we got down there, and I started seeing the habitat myself, I realized it was a lot more complex, that there was mystery and misinformation about the cats out there. I also found it really fascinating that this species, the most beautiful one we have in this country, had never been documented well on video, ever. How did you manage to capture the footage of ocelots? We had custom camera traps made by a guy in the UK, then had to customize them for South Texas brush, and develop a triggering system to turn them on when the ocelots came by. It took a lot of trial and error to figure out where the ocelots were and the right camera system to capture them. It was a big team effort. In the film, you have a strong reaction to footage of two kittens. What emotions were you feeling? We knew there was one kitten because we got earlier video of the mom carrying it around, but we didn't know there were two. We had been fighting false triggers, moisture, bad batteries. We had so many problems with our camera traps.